Chapter 39. Dr. Bonacera pulls a small retractable tape measure from his pants pocket. He measures up from the bony knob of my elbow and makes a notation in my chart. You were extremely lucky today, young lady. You risk further nerve damage every time you re-injure that shoulder. Dr. B looks at Jamie, a complication from the surgery she had last summer to treat her chronic shoulder instability. The summer before my senior year, when everyone thought I was at Marie Curie camp at Michigan Tech, I was in Ann Arbor with my aunt. The surgery was supposed to fix my shoulder. I didn't want to risk any injuries in my last year of varsity hockey. We had a shot to be repeat state champions. The University of Michigan wanted me to play on their women's hockey team. Auntie paid for the surgery so it wouldn't show up on my mother's health insurance and use the medical power of attorney Mom had signed years before, just in case anything ever happened to me while I went somewhere with my aunt. The surgeon explained the risks, but I was so certain that my surgery would take care of the problem. I was Levi Firekeeper's daughter. Hockey was in my blood. Seriously? Jamie looks at me. Why did you even play tonight? He sounds mad. I feel like an ant under the glare of a magnifying glass. My team lost because Levi got past my crappy sub, I say. Dr. B looks over his glasses at me before telling Jamie. She's a pistol, isn't she? She's something, Jamie says, pinching the bridge of his nose. Back in the Jeep, Jamie asks where I'd like to go for my birthday dinner. How about cheeseburgers at the drive-in? I say. He laughs. I was expecting something more celebratory. You ever have one of their bacon cheeseburgers? When we get our food and my celebration strawberry shake, I give directions for Jamie to drive past the golf course and follow the river. Turn here, I say, a few miles downriver. It's a trail in the woods, he comments. I know. Just follow it. A branch scrapes the top of the Jeep. My aunt and Art almost bought this lot instead of the property on the island. It's still for sale. Whoa, Jamie says when the trail ends at a clearing with Sugar Island across the river. Right? It's even prettier in the daylight. I hand Jamie our bag of burgers, his iced tea, and my shake. I grab Lily's blanket from the back. Thankful, I washed the smell out of the one I'd wrapped around the meth garbage baby. Come on, dinner and a show. We walk past a stone fireplace and crumbling chimney, all that's left of the house that used to be here. At the end of the lot, I spread the moving pad on the grass at the edge of a steel break wall with a small swatch of beach beyond. Still favoring my injured wing, I ease onto the pad. I take off my clogs and sit cross-legged, just as I did the day of the squall when we sat together in the garage bay. I wrap half the soft quilt around me and hold out the other half for Jamie. The blanket still smells like campfire. He sits next to me and we tear open the bag with my birthday dinner. The first sip of strawberry shake is the best, I declare, offering the white styrofoam cup to Jamie. He drinks from the straw. You are correct, Jamie says and leans over to kiss me. It's so sudden my smile is captured in his mouth. My birthday dinner continues as we alternate kisses with bites of bacon cheeseburgers and a shared strawberry shake, listening to the gentle waves lap the shore. Several hundred feet away, a freighter silently passes by. Here comes the after-dinner entertainment, I tell Jamie. You know how ducks leave a V-shaped pattern that fans out when they move across a pond? Boats do that too. It's called a Kelvin wake. In a few minutes, the waves from the freighter out there will hit the shore. Well, then let's make good use of the time, he says. This kiss feels urgent, our tongues meeting and retreating. When Jamie moves his lips to my neck, I look up at the stars. My good arm rises so I can rake his curls with my fingers. Donis, can I do that to you? To your hair? He asks at my neck. Jamie remembers the rules we made up on the drive to Coach Bobby's bonfire. Smoothing my hair had been TJ's move, and I didn't think I could bear to have anyone be close to me like that. Especially someone faking it. Jamie is asking for real. Yes, I say to the stars. Rising to my knees, I sit on my heels and face Jamie. He follows my lead. The blanket slips from us as the waves grow louder. Jamie kisses my lips softly as his hands brush against my temples. His kisses grow more urgent as his fingers tangle in my hair. I move my left hand to test my injured shoulder. It is sore rather than painful. I rest my left palm against Jamie's chest. My good arm slides around him. I reach beneath his jacket and shirt to feel the lean muscles of Jamie's back. The waves increase in intensity, strong enough to reach the break wall. A succession of crashes that align with Jamie's deepening kisses as he follows the length of my hair from the top of my head to the middle of my back. As the waves recede, I push against Jamie's chest. Lie back, please. He does, stretching out and reaching for me. I lie in the crook of his arm and pull the soft blanket up to our shoulders. We look at the stars. You missed the Kelvin wakes, I tell him. Worth it, Jamie says, hugging me closer. We laugh. Can I ask you something, Donis? His voice is gentle, but no longer playful. It's an odd feeling for me, dreading his question while also wanting to open up. Maybe I've been so good at being guarded that it's my default reaction? I nod. Why would you risk more nerve damage to play in the game today? I wait for my first response, telling Jamie it's none of his business, to recede. The pause allows me to dig deeper and truly consider his question, as well as what I feel ready to share. Being on the ice is where I feel closest to my dad, I say, starting with the easiest truth. I pretend he's at my games. Something about the smell of the rink and having a stick in my hand, it opens up a memory portal, I guess. We are quiet as the blinking lights of an airplane cross the sky. I like that Jamie doesn't rush to fill the silence, and I can think about what I want to say next. Surgery was supposed to fix the problem. Instead, the upper part of my arm went numb. It was a small portion, so I kept playing. I re-injured my shoulder once during regular season and again during playoffs. Each time, the numbness traveled further down my arm. I sit up and face Jamie. Can you understand how hard it was to give up something I loved so much? Does it make sense now? My giving into temptation? Just this once. To imagine my dad cheering for me? I trace the length of his scar. Jamie traces my face as if I have a scar there too. I want to be with you, I say. I want you too, he says. But we need to think it through. We're in the middle of this situation and we don't know how it will end. Jamie's comment cuts at me. It's a painful reminder that as much as he seems to fit into my world, he can't stay in it. I've been left behind before, but I was always caught by surprise. I thought it would hurt less if I saw it coming, but now I realize that knowing doesn't lessen the pain. It just gives it a head start. Tonight, I would choose not knowing. For tonight, Jamie, can it not be about that? Can it be you and me in the eye of the hurricane? Tomorrow we'll be back in the storm, but tonight, it's just us. The stars have nothing on this guy when his eyes sparkle. I bring up the necessary details. No STDs, and I have a progestin implant for birth control, but you still need a condom. I don't have any STDs either, Jamie says. We need to swing by a store, though. I kiss his cheeks. Box of condoms in the glove compartment. Courtesy of Lily. I really liked her, Donis. She was a good friend to you. He kisses me back. I nod. The best. He runs to the Jeep and a blink later is next to me. It takes athletic maneuvers to manage the logistics of removing items of clothing while remaining inside the blanket sandwich. We laugh each time the top layer shifts and cool air touches skin. I keep my lips on his, even swallowing our laughter. His warm hands reach underneath my sweatshirt. a tingle from the feathery strokes of his thumbs working in unison. He looks up at me. You sure this is what you want, Donis? We can stop any time. I know, I say. I want this. I shift myself until I find the perfect angle. Nothing beyond us matters. When Jamie groans, I silence him with my fingers flat against his mouth. He chuckles softly and kisses my fingers with such tenderness. He tries holding me in place, but I keep moving until I cry out, and for once, the newer new normal makes perfect sense. I love you, he whispers. No, 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 please, not this. I scramble out of the blanket cocoon, gulping crisp air while pulling on my jeans and fumbling with the zipper. My feet slide back into my clogs. Jamie jumps up as well. He follows me, zipping up his black dress pants. His maroon shirt is open. Shadows dance along his chest and abdomen. His panting makes his muscles ripple. Donis, is everything okay? What's wrong? I bend over as if punched in the gut. Drawing in a deep breath before shouting at my feet, you had to ruin everything by saying that. Wait, you're upset because I said I love you? My nose tickles and my throat constricts. Telling you I love you is ruining it? He repeats. He makes it sound like I'm messed up. I know all about guy lies, I say, rising to face him. It's okay. We can pretend this never happened. I scoop up both blankets and hurry to the Jeep. Behind me, Jamie inhales deeply like he has to steady himself, then rushes up behind me. Guy lies. That's what you call it? His voice rises. Did that tribal cop lie to you? Shut up. This isn't about him. I climb into the passenger seat and turn up the heater. Who else lied to you? He says, walking around to the driver's side. Everyone. I'm fishing with Dad, his favorite spot on Duck Lake. My feet dangle in the water. A leech on my pinky toe. Dad sprinkles salt to make it release, pretends to eat it. We laugh, Dad and me. His face changes as he looks across the lake. Therefore, I must be lying when I say I love you. Jamie shakes his head as if he's sorry for me. His pity pisses me off. You're the biggest liar of all, I say. A tiny voice from somewhere deep in my heart reminds me. That's not true. You know who the biggest liar is. Your lies sound so believable because you don't know what's true. You don't even know which parts of you are real and which ones are bits and pieces you invented for this assignment. It is quiet except for the engine and the heater. Donis, I don't know what just happened. His voice is soft. Why are you pushing me away? Take it back, I whisper. What you said about loving me. Please tell me why. He took me fishing on Duck Lake, I say. I dangled my feet in the water and ended up with a leech on my pinky toe. He kept a salt shaker in his box of fishing tackle, sprinkled salt and told me he was seasoning it. He plucked the leech from my toe and pretended to eat it. We both laughed. Then he looked across the lake at the sunset and got sad. When I repeat the words to Jamie, it's not my voice that I hear. I have to go away, Nadonis, just for a little while. When I come back, everything will be different. We're going to have such a good life together. Nide Giyan, Nadonis. You have my heart, my daughter. That was the last thing my dad ever said to me. I'm sick of the quivering in my voice. I make up for it in volume. Don't you know, Jamie? Love is a promise, and promises you don't keep are the worst lies of all. Chapter 40. We are silent on the drive back to Chimakwa, where we left his car. When I walk around the driver's side, Jamie wraps me in his arms. Donis, it's okay if you don't say it or feel it or are too scared to consider it. There's the investigation, and then there's you and me. I love you, and I'm not going anywhere except to that dance with you tomorrow. I close my eyes. How can he even say that he's not going anywhere? It might be true for tomorrow, but he can't promise anything beyond that. Anytime you feel sad or worried, squeeze my hand. I'll squeeze back so you won't feel alone. He breaks away and takes my hand, squeezes it with each word. I love you. The next evening, I'm in the middle of the living room when Jamie knocks on the door and Mom lets him in. The instant he sees me, his jaw drops. He stands there, in a black suit and with his hair slicked back, and doesn't move. It feels as if we are in the zone together again, except with my mother dabbing away bittersweet tears. Jamie doesn't need to say anything. It's all in his eyes. I give silent thanks to Mrs. Edwards and her tailor. My scandalous jumpsuit fits perfectly. The double-sided tape is doing its job. The lipstick is in a side pocket so I can reapply as needed. Grandmary's ruby and pearl drop earrings have replaced my starter studs. The only instruction I didn't follow was the hairdo. I left it natural, so something will be the same when I look in the mirror tonight. Mom laughs and hugs Jamie when he's still fumbling for words by the time we are heading out. It isn't until we are both in the truck that he manages to speak. You look incredible. Jamie hands me a small present. Inside is a bracelet of beaded strawberries against a black velvet band backed in black leather. I instantly know it's Cousin Eva's beadwork. She varies the shades of red glass beads so that each strawberry looks as if it would actually taste sweet. It is exquisite. I know the investigation can change things in a heartbeat, Donis, but there are things that are certain in the world. The way I feel about you and what happened last night. Jamie's fingers tickle against my inner wrist, where the blue veins show my ivory skin as he connects the jewelry clasp. I hold out my arm, marveling at his gift. I hold on to the memory of last night, the certainty of his touch, and the way my heart opens a sliver to allow trust to enter and take root. We stroll through the Superior Shores Resort as if it's a parade and each couple is afloat. The crowd cheers along the entire length from the hotel entrance to the grand ballroom. Levi and his date are ahead of Jamie and me. Stormy and his date follow us, with Mike and Macy behind them. People ooh and ah over the kaleidoscope of dresses. Macy's strapless ball gown, an explosion of rhinestones, is a crowd favorite, a showstopper. People gawk at my jaw dropper, their mouths gaping like trout on a dock. I just laugh and wave with the hand that isn't holding tight to Jamie's. Auntie and the twins shout for us, so all four couples break away from the parade. As Jamie and I walk over, we come up to a slow-moving couple in our way. Jamie squeezes my hand twice and leads me around the obstacle. Well, I know three squeezes means I love you, and I'm guessing two squeezes means to speed up, I ask. He squeezes once and halts. I laugh when he pulls me back to kiss me. Then he gives a double squeeze and continues on. We pose for pictures on the grand staircase leading to the second floor conference level. The vibrant floral carpeted steps and polished mahogany banister make for a beautiful backdrop. Teddy directs the photo shoot as if we are on America's Next Top Model. I just focus on Perry's and Pauline's excited faces. Finally, Auntie says, "Last one, I promise. Donis and all the guys." The twins grab Jamie's hand, so he begs out of the picture to twirl them like ballerinas. "Come on, Bubble," Levi says. My brother is on top of the world, standing a few steps up on the staircase and surveying the crowd below. His family, friends, team, town. He beams.
"Pose like a superhero, Auntie Donis," Perry shouts.
"Yeah," Jamie says, lifting Pauline as if she is the prima ballerina in Swan Lake. Putting my hands on my hips and trying not to laugh, I stare into the camera. Levi, Stormy, and Mike pretend to cower at my feet. Once again, Jamie looks at me with something that mixes awe and reverence. When everyone is seated in the ballroom, the festivities begin. Call Me Grant welcomes everyone to Shagala 2004. Chief Manitou gives a blessing in the language. Macy trills a lili for her dad. Coach Alberts introduces my brother and praises his leadership as team captain, then calls Levi to the stage to give the keynote address. He pauses to hug me on the way. "I am so proud of you," I whisper. "Me and Dad. I know he's here too." As Levi walks past them, people comment how handsome he looks in his tuxedo. Everyone smiles as the hockey god steps to the podium. He begins by apologizing to his ancestors if he says any of our Ojibwe words incorrectly. He introduces himself in Anishinaabe Mo'in, then translates what he said. When Levi continues with his speech, I raise my eyebrow. The voice I hear is not his normal one. My brother speaks with exaggerated inflections and dramatic pauses. The more Levi talks, the more I hear him doing that forced, "I am but a humble Indian" routine. A nearby Zaganash lady wipes tears from her eyes because she is so touched by my brother's words, his story about what hockey means in his life. When he mentions being a hope for his people, I actually wince. The only thing missing is mystical flute music in the background and an eagle landing on his shoulder. Levi sounds like a few cultural leaders who make a big show about being capital T traditional. They're quick to judge others, but bristle and turn mean when anyone points out their own shortcomings. My brother finishes, and the audience roars their admiration. He shakes hands with people and high-fives the other soups as he returns to his seat. Levi grins at me. "So? How'd I do?" It was kinda fake. Like you were performing for the Zaganash. Levi laughs, as if my stunned reaction was his entertainment for the evening. "Just giving the people what they want," he begins eating his salad. "Holy, who are you to call out anyone?" Macy laughs across the table. "You got in by one vote." I flush with anger and embarrassment. Even with the familial paternity test and 26 elder affidavits and all the other paperwork, it still wasn't good enough for some council members. They still let me know that, to them, I will always be on the outside looking in. Macy's superpowers are snarky insults and teasing comments with just enough truth to sting. Some Nishkwewog have the ability to convey that they aren't laughing with you, they are very much laughing at you. It bugs me to no end when Macy Manitou scores a direct punch. My brother waves his white napkin ceasefire. "Come on now, Mace. That's what siblings do." He smiles warmly at me. "They tell the truth. Donnie is just keeping it real. Besides, it's time for her birthday present." Levi sets a wrapped shoebox on the table. My heart races. He must have found the scarf. Opening the gift, I remove layers of white tissue paper to reveal not a scarf. It's a man's choker, with beads carved from bone, solid and timeless. I stare at Levi with an unspoken question. He smiles and nods. "It's Dad's choker from his regalia. I found it when I was looking for the scarf." Levi looks down at the slice of cake placed before him. "I'm sorry I couldn't find it, but I wanted you to have this." I can't speak or else I will cry. My dad wore this. He wore it when he danced. When I hug my brother, he whispers in my ear, "I left a surprise at your house." My voice cracks when I tell him, "Chimigwich." After dinner, Call Me Grant and Mrs. Edwards take turns introducing each player and his date. They start with team captain Levi and his date, who head to the dance floor. The players are then announced in chronological order of when they made the team. It takes a while for them to get to the rookie soups. From Rockville, Maryland, Jamie Johnson and our very own Donis Fontaine. There is applause along with shouts of my name and various nicknames.
I grip Jamie's hand as he leads me to a spot near Levi and his date. He squeezes back 3 times. My breath quickens and my stomach tumbles in the most pleasurable way. I'm not ready to squeeze back, but I am ready to enjoy tonight. When the music begins, I put my arms around his waist, admiring my beautiful bracelet. We sway to a slow song. Jamie inhales my hair and sighs contentedly. I'm glad I didn't use any styling products that might have covered up the scent of strawberry-scented shampoo. Chi mi guich, o ji xingui, I say for his ears only. He raises an eyebrow. O ji xingui, it means he has a scar on his face. O ji xingui, Jamie says slowly. He repeats it until the name flows smoothly. Then he adds, mi guich. Do you have an Indian name? A spirit name, yes. He waits for me to tell him what it is. I gave away too much of myself to men who didn't deserve me, Auntie has said. Jamie and I are in a good place right now. We have so much to learn about each other. I don't know his real name. Until I know it, and much, much more, I think that I'm comfortable with what I shared today, but not anything else. Not yet, Oji Xingui, I say. Once we're on the other side of this, someday. Tomorrow, Sunday, he says. We both smile. The next song pulses with energy, bringing a swarm of people to the dance floor. Dancers form 2 lines, couples facing each other, spaced far enough apart for the couple at the start of the line to dance their way down the aisle. I look across at Jamie as we sidestep our way to the front of the line. I am curious if he will be as good a dancer as I suspect. Levi is next to me. When it's his turn to dance, he tries to pull me to dance with him. I yank my hand back and laugh. Holy, dance with your date, clueless guy. He laughs too, and joins the girl with the frozen smile who is waiting for him. Levi shows off vintage moves like the electric slide and running man. Granny June was right. My brother is the dancer in the family. When it's our turn, I meet Jamie at the start of the dance line. I apologize in advance for my dancing. Be gentle with my shoulder. I've got this, he says with a wink. Jamie twirls me and everyone cheers. He stands behind me, holding my hurt arm close to my side, bent at the elbow, and with his hand atop mine at my stomach. He extends the other arm out with a firm grip. He leads me down the dance line. Jamie dances the same way he skates, grace and skill blending effortlessly. When Levi imitated him in international waters, it was a comic exaggeration of Patrick Swayze. Jamie's moves are as smooth as skate blades, hot off the sharpening machine, slicing through the ice. Every few steps he spins me by my good arm, always protecting my clipped wing. We finish to thunderous applause and hoots. We looked fantastic. It was all Jamie. Mike and Macy are up next. His robotic moves contrasted with her slinky belly dancer gyrations. Her parents follow, and everyone goes wild when Chief Manitou and his wife do a variation of a powwow two-step. Then TJ dances with Olivia Wang. She graduated the year between TJ and me. He is surprisingly light on his feet for a big guy. He smiles at her as they make their way down the dance line. His forehead is shiny and sweat trickles from his temples. I don't feel my insides churning. It's more like, I used to know that person, and now I don't. Jamie and I smile at each other. He motions for us to go back to our table. All good? He says. Yes. I plant a kiss on his cheek, and I'll be even better after I hit the ladies' room. The line is out the door at the restroom closest to the ballroom, so I run up the floral staircase to access the restroom by the conference rooms. Halfway up, Ron calls my name. I wait at the landing for him to catch up. We need to talk, now, he says. This is not good. We find an empty meeting room next to a loud private party. I don't want to stand close to him, but we can't have anyone overhear what is going to be an unpleasant conversation. What happened yesterday? He waits for my answer, not rushing to fill the awkward space with additional chatter. "What do you mean?" "Cut the crap. Don't answer my question with a question. What happened last night?" "I'm not about to snag and brag. It's not any of his... And before you tell me it's not any of my business, let me remind you that everything he does is my business. You know about the benefit hockey game last night? Well, I hurt my shoulder and Jamie took me to the emergency room so my doctor could make sure I hadn't damaged anything. And now we're here."
"And now you're here. Doing what, exactly? I saw you two on the dance floor. What was that?"
I say nothing.
"Did he tell you how he got his scar?" "His first UC assignment. A drug bust goes bad and someone decides to slice him. If backup hadn't come through, they were going to keep cutting."
Stunned, I try to reconcile what Ron is telling me with the smooth dancer waiting for me downstairs. What else has Jamie been keeping from me?
"Now this assignment," Ron continues, "he's getting emotionally entangled with a CI, and it could jeopardize the entire investigation."
"I'm not just some emotional entanglement," I say. "Jamie and I can handle being part of the investigation and having something that's not so neatly defined."
Ron shakes his head. He's frustrated, I think. But what else can he say about it?
"Donis, you do get that there is no actual Jamie Johnson, right? There's just a rookie officer who will do anything it takes to redeem himself after his first UC assignment went to hell, including using you."
"What do you mean?"
"Jamie was the one who proposed that he get close to you."
I stare at my reflection in the ladies' room mirror, Ron's words echoing in my ears. It was Jamie's idea to start something with me? How could that be true and last night be true also? My BlackBerry chimes and I'm thankful to be pulled out of my trance.
"It's TJ, outside bathroom, coming in."
I have just enough time to go into the nearest stall as the door opens.
"Donis?"
My name sounds strangely impersonal coming from TJ. I sigh.
"What?"
He checks the stalls to make sure we are alone. His big feet plant themselves outside my locked stall.
"The guy you're with is no good."
Wow, people do not like Jamie tonight. "Go back to your date," I say tiredly.
"I will. This isn't jealousy. You moved on, I moved on. It's just that he's bad news."
"How do you know?" My voice is monotone. TJ is silent for what feels like 5 minutes. He takes a deep breath and blows it out.
"If he's new best buds with your brother, then he's bad news."
That does it. I slam open the door and glare at him. "How dare you say that? You, of all people, criticizing anyone."
"I figured we'd get into that eventually," he says. "Look, I dumped you because Levi and his goons threatened me."
I shake my head. "That makes no sense. You were a senior, the biggest guy in school. They were what, freshmen? Mike was an eighth grader."
"They said they'd find a way to get me."
"Oh, come on. Because we started dating?" I shake my head.
"Because we started having sex."
"That's crazy."
"I told Levi to piss off. He got mad I wasn't afraid of him. Scary mad. Said he'd find people to hold me down so he could slash my Achilles tendon and end football for me."
"You so much as look at her, and I will end hockey for you." My head begins to swim. I push past TJ and walk unsteadily to the sink. The bathroom has a basket of cotton washcloths instead of paper towels. I dampen one with cold water and wipe my face. TJ continues,
"I went to tribal police. The officer said, good luck getting anyone to believe me against Golden Boy."
He tries to lock eyes with my reflection in the mirror.
"I am many things," he says. "The worst was being a coward for breaking up with you without a word. But I'm not a liar."
I look in every corner of the mirror, never finding his face. "You're wrong, TJ.
I'm not wrong about your brother. I feel a responsibility to make sure you know who you're with and what your brother is capable of. Just thought you'd deserve to know. That you'd want to know.
TJ shakes his head.
Turns out the person I was wrong about is you.
Returning to the ballroom, I catch my breath next to a speaker blasting dance music, grateful for thumping bass beats pushing all bathroom revelations from my throbbing brain. The song ends as someone sidles next to me.
Ah, Donis Fontaine.
Grandma Pearl always said that bad things happen in threes. I brace myself.
That was a nasty hit on the ice yesterday,
Call Me Grant says.
How's your shoulder doing today?
Much better, I say.
Oh, that's great. He sounds overly relieved.
Let me know if you need anything for it.
Thanks, I'm good.
I keep my face a polite mask.
Wonderful.
His voice is now a purr.
I have an interesting video. Come up to my room. I'll tell you all about it.
I'm about to tell his old pervy ass to go snag himself when he continues.
A security video from my home office.
My blood turns to ice as Call Me Grant's grin stretches wider.
What a curious cat you are, Donis Fontaine.
Chapter 41. I glance over my shoulder on the walk to the hotel. Call Me Grant is 10 steps behind, greeting someone. My legs tremble. I'm an ant on a sidewalk. His laser focus is the magnifying glass.
Think of a plausible explanation, Donis. You're a smooth liar in your own right, calling out every guy who's ever lied to you, but never holding a mirror to yourself.
Call Me Grant takes the lead as the conference center connects to the hotel. I follow when he detours down a smaller hallway. Another turn reveals a service elevator. I feel my insides twist as I realize we're bypassing the main elevators because Call Me Grant doesn't want us to be seen together. He presses the call button and the door slides open. As he motions for me to enter first, his smile is pleasant. Normal. The one he uses with the other parents. I release my held breath and stride forward on steady legs.
You got this. He likes talking. Let him tell you what he knows.
If there's any hint he knows about the undercover investigation, you need to alert Ron and Jamie.
Jamie.
He never mentioned the fake relationship was his idea from the start.
Can you trust me?
The spot warms where his soft lips kissed my bare, injured shoulder in the hospital. A memory tattoo. Last night, being with him.
Ding!
The elevator opens on the top floor. When did it shut?
Forget about Jamie. Focus. Be like Gagage, the problem-solving raven.
An idea sparks as I walk toward the Ogema suite, where the Edwards family hosts their annual Shagala after party. It gains strength with each step, because it's rooted in truth.
You were in his home office to take pictures because it was a chance to be around Grandpa Lorenzo's furniture. Mom found refuge from Grand Mary's boutique in her father's office upstairs, where he hid treasures in the shelves, books for her, Uncle David, and you. Maybe he will let you buy back the furniture for her. Because when someone you love dies, you find comfort in things connected to your memories of them.
Entering the room, I blink my surprise. It isn't a suite, just an ordinary hotel room. Why? I land face first on the bed, question still in my throat. Grant, he shoved me. I feel the weight of someone pressing down on me, but this time it's not Jamie. There are no firecrackers. This can't be happening.
Why so curious about me, Donis Fontaine?
His breath is hot on my neck.
I'll tell you anything you want to know. Just ask real nice.
My arms and legs flail as I reach around, trying to grab or scratch him. Unable to kick behind me, I scream in frustration, but the sound is muffled by the bedspread. You hockey girls are my weakness.
Hockey girls. Did he mess with Robin? Is he the man she was talking about?
I channel my white hot anger and fight harder. Try to dig in my elbows and knees so I can flip over, but I can't get any leverage beneath Grant's wrestler's pin. All that vigor and skill, grit and curves, he says. His hand finds a zipper at my lower back. I freeze. His hands keep going. It's not supposed to happen to me. The bedding smells clean, like a fresh sachet. Lavender. An instant later, I watch from high above what he does to her. Alone in the elevator, I catch my reflection in its mirrored walls. The girl in the mirror takes shallow breaths. She combs her tangled hair with shaky fingers. She blinks repeatedly. Blink, 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 ding. By the time the door slides open, her hair is no longer a tangled squirrel's nest. See? Nothing happened. I return to the ballroom, music growing louder. Jamie sits at the table, along with Stormy and his bored date. Shagala is in full swing.
Holy, Stormy says. Didn't think you were one of them girls who takes forever in a bathroom.
Ignoring Stormy, I shine my widest smile on my date. Let's dance. We're so unevenly paired. Jamie is all smooth moves. Baryshnikov and Denzel in a black suit and polished dressed boots. Jamie Johnson, dancer and actor.
Don't think about it, Donis. Nothing happened. Just dance.
So I dance. There's an awkward pause when the song ends and the DJ cues the next one. The instant a drumbeat thunders from the speakers, the ballroom fills with cheers and lilies. I giggle at Jamie's wide-eyed reaction to the pandemonium. Every nish rushes to the dance floor for an honor song. Most Zaganash flee. A few look scared. I laugh even harder. Hands on hips, I stand in place and bounce on the balls of my feet to the drum beats. It's the closest I can get to dancing while still honoring my grief. Jamie stands off to the side, watching my favorite part of Shagala as if he has never seen anything so magnificent. Stormy dances next to me. I always forget he's a wolf dancer like his dad. Their regalia includes a wolf's head and hide worn like a hooded cape. He hunches forward with arms bent at elbows as if holding a feather fan in one hand and his tomahawk in the other. Jerking his head from side to side, Stormy raises his tomahawk fist in the direction of the nearest round table. A Zaganash man at the table does a double take before mimicking the movement to his friends and adding a war whoop. The people at the table don't see that Stormy's dance honors Ma'ingan. Wolf is part of Bear Clan. We are protectors and healers. I reach into my pocket for Levi's gift just before the four distinctive honor beats in the song. When they come, I raise my dad's choker to give thanks. I use my left hand, holding the gift as high as I can. The pain stabs my shoulder. When I lower my arm, the spasm reverberates through my entire body. Levi makes his way over to me. His hip-hop dance moves synchronize to the drum beats. When our eyes meet, I kiss the choker and raise it once more to Creator. My brother's smile radiates brighter than ever before. I'm the luckiest Kuei to have such a great brother. After another fast song, the DJ gives us a breather. Acoustic guitar strumming slowly. Keith Urban singing about making memories. Jamie kisses my shoulder. I jerk back.
Is it still tender?
Beautiful tawny eyes, full of concern.
No, it's not that.
I look away. Retrieving the choker from my pocket, I hold it out to Jamie.
Would you help me put it on?
He lifts my hair, letting it cascade over my shoulder. My hands press the straps of my top so he won't attempt another kiss there. His fingers brush the nape of my neck as he joins the leather ties, and I force myself not to flinch away. We sway wordlessly, my head on Jamie's shoulder. He won't see me blinking, call me Grant away. It works.
I'm 6. A happy little Kwaizan, wearing the dress Grandmary picked for me. My dad lifts me so my feet can be on top of his shoes and our steps will be the same. I look up in alarm, remembering that his legs hurt even more when it's rainy like tonight. He smiles, full of love. Gizagian, Nadanis.
I tell Jamie I'm ready to go home.
You sure? Levi said something about an after party?
No, I snap before catching myself. Sorry, I'm just tired. Day caught up with me is all. We leave hand in hand. He squeezes 3 times. We pass Macy exiting the ladies' room, looking beautiful and flushed from dancing all night. Letting go of Jamie, I rush to Macy and push her back inside. She knocks my hands away.
What the hell are you doing? She yelps.
I growl into her ear. Don't ever be alone with Grant Edwards. Jamie and I continue walking in silence. Our words are to others. I tip and thank the coat check lady who hands over my mother's wool shawl. He does the same to the valet with his truck. It's only after we leave the Superior Shores Resort that Jamie speaks to me.
What was that back there with Macy?
Nothing. My shawl hides how tightly I'm hugging myself.
Well, it looked like you were going to fight her, or kiss her, he says lightly.
I shrug my one good shoulder. Just needed to tell her something that couldn't wait.
Is everything okay, Donis? You seem so happy on the dance floor.
He looks over.
But it's like seeing Macy set you off.
Jamie, I told you it's been a long day.
My exhaustion is no act.
He follows the river back through town. I focus on a freighter entering the Sioux Locks.
You hockey girls are my weakness.
An aftershock ripples the length of my spine. Grant Edwards messed with Robin. Robin was addicted to painkillers but died from a meth overdose.
Mr. Bailey's broken voice. We were trying to get her into rehab, not college.
Grant Edwards' remark about my shoulder injury.
Let me know if you need something for it.
Jamie's route home cuts through campus.
You're supposed to tell us stuff instead of waiting to be asked, Jamie scolded.
Park behind the student union, I say before I can change my mind. I want to talk. Jamie gives me a look, but drives through the empty lot to its edge overlooking the International Bridge. If he floored it, his truck could baja the curb and go airborne.
Can you trust me?
Oh, how I wanted to, Oji Shingwe. I play out how it will go. Me. Grant Edwards might be involved with the meth cell. For sure, he had something to do with Robin's addiction to painkillers.
How do you know?
He asked about my injured shoulder today. He said he could help if I needed anything for it.
That's not enough evidence.
Well, how's this for evidence? Grant Edwards sexually assaulted me tonight in his hotel room. He held me down and when he was done, squeezed my bad shoulder. Said he could make the pain go away. When I didn't respond, he laughed and said I'd be back for more, just like Robin. Is that enough for the FBI to go after him? Jamie, what possessed you to go to a hotel room with Mike's dad? How could you make such a stupid mistake? You're supposed to be so intelligent. But all I see is a shit ton of book smarts and not 1 ounce of common sense. Why didn't you scream for help? And how in the hell could you just go limp like that? Odd how Jamie's scolding voice sounds exactly like mine. We walk toward the ledge. I halt, shaking and dizzy, while my bravery tumbles down the hill, away from me. I can't tell Jamie. Ron's FBI agent confessional replays.
Donis, you do get that there is no actual Jamie Johnson, right?
I turn to him.
What's your real name?
Startled, Jamie collects himself before answering.
I really want to tell you, but I won't.
He stares at the International Bridge for a long time, probably buying time counting the lights of the double arches on the U.S. side.
Donis, if something goes wrong in this investigation, it's safer for you to know as little about me as possible. Once we find out who's running the drug ring, if they thought you had information of use to them, you'd be in danger. Telling you could get you hurt. I'm the one who's dumbfounded now. Staring at him as cold fury courses through my veins. When I speak, my voice is ice. Because confidential informants risk getting injured or killed, right? Donis, what's going on? When you joined the investigation, you read all the materials. Got up to speed, hey?
Yeah,
he says cautiously, aware of a conversation landmine somewhere nearby. So you knew that a CI, my uncle, had died under suspicious circumstances. I take his grim expression as affirmation. And you researched me, learned about my science fair project, knew I had one parent who was native and one who was white. Something we could bond over. Jamie takes a step toward me, reaching out to embrace me. I hold up my hand to keep him at bay. Who had the idea for an undercover cop to get close to me? Whose idea was it to recruit the grieving local girl as the next CI? Surprise and guilt wash over Jamie. I wait for him to pinch the bridge of his nose, but he only stares at me. I make it a contest. He blinks first. What you need to understand, he begins stepping closer. My fist connects with his face. The crack of his nose and Stormy's goon advice from long ago register simultaneously. Aim beyond his head. The power's all in the follow-through. What the hell? He shouts, hands rising to protect his nose after the fact. That's my girl. My dad's deep voice is as clear and strong as if he were beside me. Pride eclipses my anger momentarily. Levi Joseph Firekeeper Sr. was more than a hockey god. He was the fiercest goon on either side of the International Bridge. A car barrels through the parking lot. Headlights capture us in its high beams. That's for coming up with the idea in the first place, I yell. Rushing toward him, I raise my fist again. And for going through with it, knowing I could get hurt, even after you met me. I swing and miss as he moves just beyond my reach. With nothing to break my momentum, I stumble and land face first on the ground. Instead of smelling grass, it's lavender that fills my nose. Terrified, I roll onto my back. My arms and legs swing at air. All the punches and kicks I couldn't deliver earlier. Ron bolts from the car. In an instant, he's crouched by my side. Are you okay? He helps me up. My lungs hurt from huge gulps of crisp October air. Ron looks over to Jamie. What the hell's going on? Jamie freezes, aghast. Ron, something's happened. Jamie begins in alarm. You're done, Ron interrupts. I'll get you removed from this case. You'll be lucky if anyone lets you write parking tickets. Jamie must not have heard his partner basically fire him, because he's still eyeballing me. What happened to you, Donis? His voice cracks. I really want to tell you, but I won't. Ron walks me to his car, opens the passenger door. I glance over my shoulder. Jamie stands 10 feet away, arms at his sides, bloody nose dripping onto his white shirt, still waiting for my answer. I give it. What happened to me, Jamie? You did. Chapter 42. Ron assumes I'm shaking from the temperature. He grabs a blanket from the trunk and wraps it around me like a burrito. He eases me into the car before clicking my seatbelt. We speed away. I'll drive wherever you want to go, he says. Home? Sugar Island? June Chippeways? Home, I say without hesitation. For once, I don't want to be anywhere else. If you're able to tell me, I'd like to know what happened between you and Jamie tonight, Ron says, turning into my driveway. Mom left the entry light on. I remain seated, sitting with him as the car idles. It feels familiar, comforting, even.
like when Coach Bobby drove me home after away games. I have to expect my mother to check on us. Why am I upset with Jamie but not with Senior Agent Ron for putting me in danger? A hypothetical that became very real tonight? Ron's focus has always been on the investigation. He's kind to me. I'm a helpful CI, but when this investigation is over, Ron will get up the following day and open the next case file. His professional compass always points north. At the first sign of an issue, he'll recalibrate to stay focused on the mission. Jamie made me feel like I might be more important to him than the job. There's a story about Original Man, who was given the name Anishinaabe. He was on a journey to find his parents and twin brother, but became distracted by a beautiful song in the east. Maybe that's what Ron observed. The reason why Jamie might not be cut out for undercover work. Jamie isn't good at recalibrating. I confronted Jamie about the fake relationship being his idea from the start and may have broken his nose. My second punch missed completely, and that's when you showed up. I add for clarification, it was a one-sided fight. Ron takes a minute to gather his thoughts. He's had two undercover assignments. First one leaves him with a scar, now a broken nose. His face is literally a roadmap of bad decisions. With a slow shaking of his head, he adds, "That guy better make a career change before he ends up looking like Quasimodo." I surprise myself by laughing, then snort while attempting to rein it in. Ron joins in and I lose it completely. Our belly laughs fill the car as I wipe tears from my eyes. Finally, I say goodnight. Ron waits until I unlock the front door and wave to him before he backs out of the driveway. I brace myself for Mom wanting a Shagala recap, but the house is quiet. She left a note next to the key dish. "I'm sleeping at the big house tonight. Hope you and Jamie had a nice night. See you tomorrow after Mass. Love you, Mom." She hasn't stayed overnight at the big house since Grandmary's stroke. Why tonight? Unless Mom was giving me privacy? Did she think I'd invite Jamie inside? Maybe Mom, who had to sneak around with my dad, wants to be supportive in a way her parents never were. I get ready for bed and lie under my comforter, exhausted but unable to settle myself. Instead of reciting the periodic table of elements, I reach for the choker still around my neck. My fingers touch each bead as if it were Grandmary's rosary. Instead of a Hail Mary or Our Father, I say my spirit name, the name that begins my prayers to Creator, the name I will only reveal to someone worthy of me. The strange day leaves me before I reach the end of the choker. Travis stares at Lily on the ground before returning to me. "They're so mad at me," he whispers. "The little people. I just wanted her to love me again. She's the only person who ever loved me, believed me when everyone else ditched me. If only she just tried it, Donnie. But she wouldn't. I added it to my cookies. She didn't want those either. This was the only way." He raises the gun to his temple. My eyes squeeze shut to make this all go away, the words he is saying now. "The whole town wrote me off when I said I shot that BB gun. Glass nicked that lady's eye, damaged her cornea. One more person sacrificed to the hockey god. Levi swore he'd be so grateful if I said it was me. He was the only freshman hockey player to make the varsity team. Everyone loved him. On the ice, off the ice, on the res, in town. Levi was supposed to be the best of us. I said okay. I told Coach Bobby it was me. Lily believed me when I told her the truth. She just couldn't hurt you with it. She's the best. Don't you see? I had to take her with me." I open my eyes in time to see his head snap sideways. One hand touches my choker while the other muffles my sobs. I stay like that until Zagasikwe dutifully lifts the sun to begin another day. When sunlight fills my bedroom, my eyes are drawn to the red outfit draped over the desk chair. I never want to see it again. Instead, I focus on the gift-wrapped box on the desk. Green metallic gift wrap, silver ribbon and bow atop the shoebox-sized present.
I left a surprise at your house.
Levi's whisper brings back the incandescent glow on his face as I kissed Dad's choker and raised it during the honor beats. My fingers flutter at my neck. Each bead is a memory from last night. Jamie, Brant Edwards, TJ, Stormy, Macy, Ron, and Travis.
Levi was supposed to be the best of us.
I bring the gift back to bed, where I unwrap the shiny package. It's a framed picture of Levi, Dad, and me. As I pore over it, I feel the stretch of my wide smile. My brother and I each sit on a knee. Dad has an arm around each of us. Levi and I are 4 years old. My smile is a copy of Dad's. Levi's face is his mother's, but the laughter in our eyes is the same.
Levi swore he'd be so grateful if I said it was me. Everyone loved him, on the ice, off the ice.
I love my brother. But what if he is less than who I thought he was? I dress in my running clothes, leggings and layers of shirts beneath a hoodie. My morning prayer begins with my spirit name, my clan, and where I am from. Which of the seven grandfathers should I include? What if I ask for something I shouldn't? I could be a bird asking Creator for love, only to be so enamored of my new mate that I fly into a clean window and break my neck. Everything has strings attached. Unintended consequences. The shove from behind that you never saw coming. Flakes of Sema flutter from my trembling hand. My prayer ends with a confession. I'm scared. I run as if chased by something menacing. Hot breath at the nape of my neck. It isn't until I reach the wooded lot that I take in my surroundings. Sugar Island across the river, the grass still flattened from the Jeep tires. 2 days ago, I was happy, kissing Jamie, sharing myself with him. It seems a lifetime ago. Yesterday, my brother was on top of the world. Team captain, hockey god, the prince of Shagala, the pride of Sault Ste. Marie and Sugar Island. TJ called him Golden Boy. What if the terrible things about Levi are true? Creator, I can't take any more. I just want to be a clueless girl living in her own bubble. Retracing my steps, I jog back. My pace slows the closer I get to home, exhausted and with dread growing inside me. Mom hasn't returned from Sunday Mass yet. A hot bath might ease the tension throughout my body. While waiting for the water to fill the deep soaking tub, I go to my bedroom and stare at my laptop. It's October 3rd. The bank lady said monthly statements are sent after the first of the month. Of course, maybe they wait until the following business day and September's bank statement won't show up till tomorrow. All I have to do is check for an email from the bank in Canada. If it's not there, I can soak until my fingers are pruney before getting on with the rest of my day. And if it is there, I want it to confirm Levi's explanation about investing in land near Searchmont. Because, just like with Uncle David, I've allowed a tiny seed of doubt to germinate. I hold my breath while logging into my email account. It arrived Friday afternoon, right after Mrs. Bonacera's email titled, "Read this to your mother." Mrs. B always sends medical journal articles pertaining to Grand Mary's condition. I'm supposed to translate them for Mom. I click on the attached bank statement. The starting and ending balances for September are what the bank lady told me on the phone. $10,856.77. But over the course of the month, my brother deposited $20,000 and then wired it to a bank in Panama. My heart breaks with a thud. Levi is the mule. The water drains from the tub. I don't remember changing my mind about taking a bath. Levi is the mule. I stare into the vanity mirror. Questions multiply exponentially in my mind. Grabbing a hold of one question to steady myself, I ask my reflection, "For how long?" I halt at the painted brick house with its indigo shutters and the studio apartment over the two-car garage. The driveway is empty. I peek in the garage window. It's empty. Dana Firekeeper always stays at the Superior Shores Resort for the entire Shagala weekend. Levi and Stormy should be at Mike's parent-free house. The back entrance to the garage is unlocked. I enter, and Waylon growls from behind a door leading to the house. When I call his name, his tone changes from protector to friend. A set of narrow stairs at the farthest garage stall leads to a second entrance to Levi's room. I try the door. Locked. Figured as much. I stand in the backyard, looking up at the three dormer windows above the garage. My empty stomach somersaults. I shiver from hot skin gone clammy in the crisp October morning. The spare key is still kept underneath a garden gnome figurine in the flower bed next to the back entrance. I unlock the door and return the key to its hiding spot. When I enter the house, Waylon drops a stuffed bear at my feet. I toss his toy and the German Shepherd dashes down the hallway. Levi's school pictures run the length of the stairwell, beginning with his brand new senior portrait. My brother becomes younger with each step. Middle school photos show a confident preteen with zero awkwardness. His charming smile never changes, but his face softens during his elementary school years. At the top of the stairs, he is a round, sweet, 3-year-old preschooler. Waylon nudges my hand with his toy. I fling the bear, which lands in front of senior year Levi. French doors at the top of the stairs open to a small wrought iron balcony overlooking the wooded backyard. The stair landing leads either to the main house or to the garage apartment. I try the door to Levi's space. Also locked. I take a deep breath and blow it out in an exaggerated sigh. A few years ago, I watched my brother break into his bedroom. He had lost his key and Dana hadn't hidden the spare yet. Stormy, Mike, Travis, and I were in the backyard, watching Levi scale the trellises framing the back entrance to reach the balcony. Mike led us in chants of Spider-Man to cheer on Levi as my brother jumped to the garage roof and slid open a dormer window. As with everything, he made it look effortless. Waylon races up the stairs to join me. I wrestle the slobber damp bear and throw it back to senior year Levi. It feels like a race between the dog and me. Who can reach our goal first? I turn the handle on one of the French doors and step onto the shallow balcony. I shut the door behind me. My fatigued quads twitch in anticipation and I hear the guy shouting, "Spider-Man!" I only have time for two deep breaths before I jump the short distance to the garage roof. I land on all fours, my shoulders screaming in protest. The peak of the roof didn't seem this steep from the ground or in my memories. The instant I tell myself not to look down, I do, and I feel an urge to pee myself. This was stupid. Does it really matter how long Levi's been distributing meth? What more proof do I want? Waylon barks from the other side of the French doors, as if agreeing. I force my breath to slow down and lie there until my heartbeat matches. Moving sideways in tiny increments, I reach the nearest window. When I looked up at the windows, each was open slightly to let in fresh air. Dana blasts the heat like a sweat lodge from October through April. She doesn't care how high their heat bills run. Levi will never wake up shivering. My heart beats double time as I pry the screen from the window. The plan, which I'm making up as I go along, is to put the screen back once I'm inside the room. The screen takes more effort, coming loose all at once. I teeter off balance, dropping the screen. I grip the windowsill. The screen hits the fieldstone patio below, and I register the time it took to reach the ground. If I fall off the roof, it will take approximately 2 seconds until I splat. I push the window up until I can fit through the opening. I land clumsily inside while Waylon barks from outside Levi's bedroom door. I stand. Now what? I start with the nightstand beside the queen-sized platform bed. Next to the lamp is a large bottle of ultra-moisturizing hand lotion and a box of tissues. Gross. I brace myself. Searching my brother's bedroom means I can't ever unsee stuff. Moving to Levi's desk and dresser, I go through every drawer in the bedroom. I pull out each one to look underneath and behind for any secret documents. Levi doesn't have a wall of bookcases, like Mike, just a set of bunk beds along one wall. The bedding on the lower bunk is messy. Stormy sleeps there, further confirmed by a half-empty bag of Cheetos within reach on the floor. The top bunk is perfectly made, as if made by someone in boot camp. Mike stays over, though less frequently than Stormy. I look under each mattress, careful to leave each in its pre-search state. Outside the door, Waylon paws at the door, reminding me he still wants to play. An enormous plasma screen takes up the wall above a rectangular coffee table with precise stacks of video games next to Levi's PlayStation 2 and Mike's Xbox. Facing the screen are a trio of video gaming chairs, low to the floor like a cross between beanbag chairs and children's car seats. A fourth chair is banished to a corner, Travis's chair. But maybe Levi will let Jamie be their fourth. I slide the closet door open to view half of the contents, clothing, shoes, and plastic totes filled with hockey gear. I quickly go through each box. Most are filled with hockey tournament program booklets, hockey magazines, and hockey playbook drawings on graph paper, X's and O's in formations with dotted lines. This is stupid. What am I doing here? I am sweating from the heat and understand Levi's need to keep windows open. A glance out the screenless window reveals a squirrel squawking from a nearby tree, also agreeing with my stupidity. Returning to the closet, I move on to the other side, where my brother keeps his clothes. The shelf above has smaller boxes and a black ash basket. I go in order. There is a shoebox, the same brand as the one Levi wrapped Dad's choker in. Inside are bank statements from our joint account. He hasn't received the statement from September yet, so I start with August. I check the beginning and ending balances before eyeballing the activity during the month. He wired $10,000 to the same bank in Panama, the month when Lily was killed. I go through July's statement, another wire transfer, and again for June and May. In April, the amount wired was $15,000. It was $20,000 per month for March, February, and January. In 2003, he wired the same amount for December, November, and October. Hockey season runs mid-September through mid-April. He wired more money in hockey months, but he was still running money through our account during non-hockey months. How could he be a meth mule year-round? Is that why he's always using Dana's boat for trips to Mackinac Island in the summer? There was no unusual activity in September 2003. It was a partial hockey month, but the statement shows nothing but normal purchases at stores at the mall across the river. Same for the summer months before that. What was so special about October last year? Why did Levi start being a meth mule then? The common sense realization comes far later than it should. The wire transfers began when Levi became a soup. But how could a minor authorize wire transfers from a Canadian bank to one in Panama? Levi was a junior when he made the team. He wouldn't turn 18 until January. Meanwhile, I was a senior, turned 18 in October, and my brother was a minor. I wasn't. I am frozen on the floor next to the shoebox. More than a year of bank statements are laid out around me. Could Levi have made the wire transfers in my name? The floor rumbles as the garage door rises. Waylon rushes downstairs barking. Someone is home. Chapter 43. I quickly refold the statements as a vehicle enters the garage. It sounds like Dana's Mercedes rather than the behemoth Hummer. I finish just as she enters the house from the garage. Waylon barks persistently. What's going on, big guy? Dana calls from the bottom of the stairs. He's ratting me out, is what's happening. Waylon runs upstairs as I finish putting the statements in order in the shoebox. Squawk! I jump at the noise. A squirrel shouts at me from the windowsill. I reach for the nearby bag of Cheetos and toss one wrinkled orange stub toward the window. The squirrel is supposed to flee. Instead, it comes further into the room and protests more. Squawk! Waylon dashes upstairs. His barks set off the squirrel, which does a frantic lap around the room, too scared to retrace its steps back to the window. What the hell is going on? Dana shouts, running up the stairs. What if she can unlock the door? My hands shake so badly that I knock the black ash basket while returning the shoebox to the shelf. It slips through my fingers. Dana tries the door handle. When I turn to scoop up the basket, its matching lid is a step away. I pick up the basket by the opening. Something soft brushes against my fingertips. My heart skips a beat. I tip the basket upside down, staring at the floor where Dad's scarf lands. Green, like my mother's eyes. Levi kept it from me. He had it all along. Heart racing, I shove the scarf into my hoodie pouch. Waylon goes crazy on Dana's side, and the squirrel dashes around on my side. This is Judge Dana Firekeeper. I think she's talking to me until she says, I live at 124 Hilltop Court. Someone's in my house. My dog's going crazy, and someone's in my son's room. Dana called 911. I put the lid on the basket and return it to the shelf. Please, Waylon, bark louder so it masks the closet door. Bam! Dana kicks at the door while I dash to the other one, leading to the garage. Bam! I turn the deadbolt latch and grasp the doorknob with the push-button lock in its center. Opening the door, I push the button to relock it. I can't do anything about the deadbolt. Bam! I reach the top step and close the door behind me. Crack! Dana bursts into Levi's bedroom as I practically ski down the stairs. While I race to the back door of the garage, Dana shrieks at the squirrel running around the room. Waylon loses his damn mind. I stay close to the garage, beneath the overhang of the roof in case Dana looks out the window. Then I tiptoe along the side of the garage, listening for footsteps chasing me, eyeballing my target, the street beyond the trees at the end of the driveway. The barks grow fainter, like Waylon is tearing down the hallway. There's the shattering of something delicate, a crystal vase, maybe, and Dana swearing. I take my chances and run like hell. Mom's car is gone, but I still lock myself in the bathroom. My heart thumps like Wabus after a narrow escape. Something sour churns in my stomach an instant before I violently heave greenish-yellow bile. It leaves me exhausted and hunched over the toilet. The emptiness inside me is replaced by something far worse. Nibwakawin. Auntie told me the translation, breaking down each part of the word so it made perfect sense. To be wise is to live with an abundance of sight. My whole life I've wanted to be like my aunt, the way a person dreams about being a ballerina, but not of broken toes and years of practice. I wanted to be a strong and wise Nishkawe, never considering how that abundance of sight would be earned. I wanted to find out who was involved in the meth madness that took Lily and Uncle David, Robin and Heather, too, and the kids in Minnesota who got so sick from Meth X. The person I was searching for this whole time was Levi. Wisdom is not bestowed. In its raw state, it is the heartbreak of knowing things you wish you didn't. Mom comes home while my stomach heaves. I turn on the fan to muffle my retching. Her feet make dark shadows at the bottom gap of the door, next to Harry's paw reaching underneath for invisible prey. Are you okay, honey? Her soft voice is full of concern. Yeah, just ate something bad. I wait for her to move away from the door. She does, but returns a few moments later.
I've got some Gatorade for you.
Once she mentions it, my dry throat wants nothing more.
Can you leave it by the door?
I croak. Mom can't help with this situation. I try to dry heave more quietly so she will leave. I don't hear her anymore. She must have stepped away. I slide the pocket door. Harry bursts in as soon as there's clearance for her fat body.
Are you pregnant?
Mom sits with her back against the wall, opposite the bathroom door. I shudder while reaching for the neon yellow drink.
No, I'm on birth control.
Thank God for Norplant. Mom looks away. I watch for clues to her reaction.
I'm glad you have Teddy.
Mom doesn't seem glad, more like disappointed.
But you have me too. You can bring your problems to me instead of keeping secrets.
She takes a deep, steadying breath.
If you ever get into a situation, I will always help you.
If I robbed a bank, you'd drive the getaway car? I say, smiling weakly. She nods.
I'd make sure you wore a seatbelt, too.
I crawl to her. She kisses my forehead. Leaning against her, I rest my head on her shoulder. The weight of my secrets is exhausting. My whole life has been filled with them. Even as a zygote, I floated in an embryonic sack of secrecy. If I tell Mom one secret, will I vomit the rest of my secrets all over her? And which one would I open with? Do I start with the earliest one and work forward? Or last in, first out? Uncle David would have me tackle the highest priority first and list all the rest in descending order. I decide to begin with the secret that provides the foundation for all the rest. It's hard to tell you things because I don't want you to worry or to let you down. I've already caused you so much pain.
Pain? Her surprise is genuine. Donis, you are the greatest joy of my life.
But I'm the reason your life is stuck in limbo now. If I hadn't been born, maybe everything could have been different for you and Dad. Then I say the worst thing I've ever heard about myself. I was the first of all the bad things for both of you. She looks at me in astonishment, until an epiphany flickers in her eyes. It lights up her face.
Children are never to blame for their parents' lives. Parents are the adults. We are the ones responsible for our choices and how we handle things.
She sits taller at the revelation.
If I'm in limbo, it's because I chose to remain there. Even inaction is a powerful choice.
Mom rises with an abundance of sight, holds out her hand for me. I take it. She lifts me into a tight embrace that flows through me, continues through the earth's crust and mantle, making its way to the solid inner core.
My life, my choices, she says, not yours.
My second attempt at a bath goes better. Mom runs the bath water for me and adds her favorite bubble bath. When my thoughts go to Levi and what I need to do next, I turn on the bath jets and disappear beneath a mountain of lilac-scented bubbles. An hour later, I zip my black jeans with pruny fingers. The sports bra I grab is also black and has wide straps to cover the purple bruise branding my shoulder to hide the evidence. As I pull on a black Henley, there's one moment when my raised arms are immobile, and I feel his words on the back of my neck. The hallway cameras recorded you coming here willingly.
Will it be like this from now on?
Flashbacks? A scent? Remembering things he said that I hoped to forget? A bite-shaped bruise I'll still see long after it fades? I wish I'd never agreed to be a CI.
Donis, honey. I just remembered. Levi stopped by yesterday on his way to Shagala. So handsome in his tuxedo.
Mom's voice travels down the hallway ahead of her footsteps.
You haven't said a word about last night. How was everything?
I quickly check my appearance in the full-length mirror next to my bedroom door.
It was fine,
I say. Fine, fine, fine. Mom continues from the doorway.
Just fine. Did you and Jamie have a fight?
Her brow furrows.
Something like that, I say. Do you want to talk about it?
I'm good, Mom. I smile so the crease at the top of her nose will smooth out. It does. She looks around my bedroom, zeroing in on the unwrapped gift.
What did Levi give you?
I reach for the framed photo already on my nightstand, turn it toward her. Mom's first smile is for the overall image. Her second is for my father. After 20 years, she remains besotted with him. I'm torn between seeing her devotion as a triumph or as an anchor weighing her down. Can it be both? I don't see how. Reluctantly, she tears her gaze away from him.
Didn't Levi give you another present? She asks.
I look around.
I think this is it, I say.
But he walked in with two boxes, one gift wrapped and one plain. He said he'd leave them in your room. I shrug, feeling my sore left shoulder. I must be imagining it, but I can almost feel the clenching of his fingers. Mom tells me it's time for her to head to Evercare. Do I need anything before she leaves? I want answers. No, I don't. Curiosity killed the cat. Doubt tore her into pieces. Mom leaves. As soon as the front door closes, I look for Levi's second box. My brother gave me the choker at Shagala last night and the framed photo for me to find today. Where is the other gift? It feels like deja vu from searching Levi's bedroom earlier today. I check beneath my mattress, under my bed, each desk drawer and dresser drawer, every bookcase shelf. I pause to ask myself aloud if I'm losing my mind. I get no response. I continue to the closet, top shelf, second shelf, boxes of shoes, my fuck you pumps. I slide hangers of outfits Grand Mary hoped I'd wear. The bottom of my closet has a laundry hamper and my hockey gear duffel bag. My stinky uniform will rot if I don't wash it. I pick up my bag to drag it into the sunlight. There's a cardboard box beneath the gear bag. Is this what my mom saw? Why would Levi hide a birthday gift for me? I forget about my smelly undershirt, clingy shorts, team uniform, and socks. When I open the box, it's filled with plain hockey pucks. I don't understand why this would be a gift for me. I claw my way to the middle of the box, grab a random puck, and raise it like buried treasure. It's a smeared Dreamcatcher hockey puck, the same kind from the weekend in Green Bay. Things that make me angry about the damn puck. 1. Dreamcatchers. Seriously. 2. Substandard printing of said Dreamcatchers on pucks going to Nish kids. 3. Donated by Grant Edwards, Coach Bobby said. 4. The pucks aren't even regulation weight. I only realize the last item on the list when the puck is in my hand. It's slightly lighter. Most people would never notice. But as someone who played for years and slept with a puck under her pillow the night before games, I can tell. My thumb slides along the bottom of the puck, feeling a hairline crack. Yet another complaint for my list. Eyeballing the bottom of the puck, I see that the crack runs just inside the perimeter. Not a crack. The puck has a lid. I use the rubbery underside of my mouse pad to hold the bottom of the puck in place while I twist the lid. A folded paper towel nests in the partly hollow middle. I peel back its corners to reveal the hidden treasure that has devastated my community and countless others. The crystals resemble uncut raw diamonds, cloudy, lesser quality specimens, made haphazardly, without regard for precise protocols. My meth was so much better. Even Jamie's would score a higher price than this crap. The hidden treasure is the answer to a question I hadn't thought to ask until now. How does Levi, the mule, distribute meth to other communities? The question I don't want to ask myself. Why would my brother leave a box of these hockey pucks in my bedroom? Mathematics, like science, has a language. Although I'm not passionate about math the way I am about science, I am functionally fluent in its numbers, letters, notations, symbols, and jargon. Scientists and mathematicians approach problems differently. Scientists collect data in order to disprove a null hypothesis, the absence of a difference or relationship. In contrast, mathematicians seek to prove a theory rather than disprove it. A proof is a set of conditional statements that build logically to a conclusion, thereby turning a theory into a theorem. A deep theorem is a proof that is particularly lengthy or complex, or includes unexpected connections. Right now, I need both approaches to work through this. I sit on my bed with Dad's scarf draped over my shoulders, the paper towel of crystal meth in one hand and his choker in the other. A fierce battle is being waged in my head. The null hypothesis that Levi Firekeeper has nothing to do with the meth devastation versus Donis Fontaine's deep theorem of her brother's involvement in all the bad things. If the FBI is investigating meth activity aligning with the Supes team schedule, then people of interest include players, players' families, coaching staff, and fans. If Uncle David hid his notebook where only I could find it and wrote in a code he knew I could decipher, then he clearly wanted me to know that the new mushroom he found was not connected to Meth X and did not cause the group hallucination. If the Nish kids weren't having a mushroom-induced group hallucination, then what they saw was a shared encounter with Anishinaabeg spirit beings. If my uncle chose not to reveal the dead-end information with the FBI, then he intended for them to continue on a wild goose chase. If Uncle David went missing after sharing his concerns about Lightbulb, the bright student involved in meth, with Lightbulb's mom, then the parent, Angie Flint, needs to be questioned about my uncle's suspicious death. If the fake pucks were how meth was being distributed, then the person donating the pucks, Grant Edwards, is involved. If bank statements showing foreign wire transfers were found in the team captain's bedroom, then that player, Levi Firekeeper, is part of the meth operations and laundering his share of the profits. If the wire transfers were made in my name to an offshore account and the pucks were planted in my closet, then that player, my brother, is setting me up. If Levi has been setting me up, then he is part of the meth cell, and he is connected to the devastation meth has caused in our community and everywhere else it has been distributed. If Levi has been weaving this web around me, tighter and tighter, then what will he do next? My BlackBerry buzzes with an incoming text at the same time as I hear urgent knocking at the front door. I react like a guilty person, hiding the scarf inside the pumpkin dress at the back of my closet. The puck fits in the dress pocket. I grab my phone while rushing to the front door. Ron, have you heard from Jamie since last night? My first thought, hell no. My second, that must be Ron at the door. My third, why would Ron be texting and knocking at the same time? At the door is the last person I expect to see. Dana. Fear grips me. Did she see me running away from her garage? She's shaking and crying. Not angry. She's scared. Can you help me? She pleads. It's Levi. I think he's in trouble. Chapter 44. A frantic Dana rushes inside before I can react. She's hyperventilating so badly that I automatically usher her to the nearest chair in the dining room. Brown paper bags. Mom keeps some in the pantry for student treat bags. I'm back in a flash with one, guiding Dana to bend over and breathe into it. When you hyperventilate, your body expels carbon dioxide too quickly, I say. Recycling your breath restores the correct balance of oxygen and carbon dioxide. She coughs a laugh into the bag. Embarrassed, I look away from her. Sorry, I'm rambling. I bounce on the balls of my feet, anxious for Levi's mom to calm down enough to let me know what the hell's going on. Dana rubs her throat. Must be dry. Tea. Mom and both my grandmas would fix a cup of tea in this situation. I dash back to the kitchen and fill half a kettle from the tap. After I turn the gas burner to its highest setting, I return with a teacup and a basket of assorted tea packets.
"Please," Dana says, looking up from the bag.
"You too. I have a lot to tell you."
"Can I really turn in my brother to the FBI?"
I grab a teacup for myself. When Dana selects chai, I do the same. By the time the tea kettle whistles, Dana's breathing has returned to normal. I pour the steaming water into our dainty china teacups and return the kettle to the cooktop. On my way back to the dining table, I bring a carton of milk and the sugar bowl. My hands shake, along with Dana's. Neither of us can wait for the tea to steep properly. We use milk to cool it down. I sip it and realize Mom must not have rinsed all the dish soap from my cup. I grimace and add sugar to make it drinkable. Whatever it is that she wants to tell me must be truly awful, because I finish my tea waiting for her to begin.
"Levi is mixed up in something bad," Dana says finally.
"What is it? How bad?" I hope I'm doing a decent job of looking shocked.
"It has to do with that Travis mess. I'm so sorry about your friend Lily."
I blink at the mention of her name, surprised at how fresh the grief still feels. Dana continues,
"Travis was bad news, but my boy is a loyal friend. He'd go to Sugar Island to talk sense into Travis. Even Stormy knew when to cut his losses, but Levi kept trying.
My brother goes to the island often, but I've always thought it was to take Stormy to his house. Stormy doesn't like going alone because he never knows how his parents are doing until he steps inside.
My boy used to think goodness was stronger than darkness." Dana taps her teaspoon as if sending an urgent message in Morse code. "But my Nokomis always said, you can't be around that much darkness without some of it touching you."
Dana thought Levi was spending time with Travis for well-intentioned interventions, when in fact he was the mule for the meth that Travis was making. At what point did Dana catch on?
Darkness touched him? I ask.
One corner of her mouth twitches before she nods.
"He used to confide in me.
Most boys don't tell their mothers much, but Levi did. Once he made that team, became a soup, I noticed him shutting me out, just a little at first."
As Dana continues talking about Levi, her voice sounds far away, like it's coming from the end of the hallway instead of across the table. I concentrate on her words. "I tried talking him out of getting the Hummer. It was too much for a 16-year-old boy. He got so angry. I ended up buying it for him. I know I shouldn't have, but I wanted things to go back to the way they were between us." Levi can be relentless when he wants something. He pestered me to be Stormy's date for Shagala last year when that was the last thing I wanted. "I went to Shagala with Stormy." I trail off, unsure what point I was trying to make. "That's odd." Dana's mouth is moving, but all I hear is Ron's last text. Inside my head, his voice repeating it, growing more urgent each time. "Have you heard from Jamie since last night? Have you heard from Jamie since last night? Have you heard from Jamie since last night?"
"One of Levi's teachers noticed it too, came to see me. Have you heard from Jamie since last night?"
Would you excuse me? I need to text someone," I say, but I'm not sure if the words actually make it out of my mouth. I push away from the table. My hands touch the rug before I realize that I'm on the floor.
"Get up, Nadonis. Bazigoen Jisen."
Harry boops my nose with her tiny cold one. I laugh. Dana coos as if I'm a baby. A wobbly baby deer. She helps me stand. So good to me. I recognize her perfume. Same as Mom's. Did they smell the same to my dad? She walks me to the front door. We slowly ease down the steps. Everything spins. "Wish t-shirt." "It's important," I think. Dana sighs wearily. Helps me into an old pickup truck. "All you Fontaines ever do is mess things up." Uncle David went to see Lightbulb's mom. It wasn't Angie Flint. Part 3. Ningabian, West. In the western direction, the journey focuses on the ripened berries and the harvest, a time of constant change. Chapter 45. I love camping. The smoky scent fills the air and burrows into fabric, hair, and skin. Hold on. It's camping, but mixed with stale air. A closed-up, musty space. My head throbs with my heartbeats. More smells. Musky sweat and a nearby piss pot. I strain to open one eyelid, like breaking the crusty bond of a meningue eye. Thin rectangles of orange light come from a wood stove across a small room. The light flickers, casting faint orange stripes against the walls and curved ribs. I blink both eyes in slow motion, trying to focus on my surroundings. It's an old aluminum trailer with a rounded ceiling and only one window, the kind people use as powwow food vendor trucks. Art calls them canned hams. I lift my head. Or try to. The trailer spins like a centrifuge. Donis. I jerk my head at the sound of Jamie's voice. He sounds like he caught a cold. But it's my head that feels foggy. He repeats my name. Each one pulses inside my skull. Donis. 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 My groans form a word. Stop. Are you okay? What did they do to you? Jamie's breath is sour. He tries wrapping me in his arms, but something about being held makes my heart race. Don't. I push him away. Your breath reeks. We're kidnapped. In a trailer somewhere. But my bad breath is what's bothering you? Even Jamie's soft laughter has a stuffed-up nasal tone. Kidnapped. Trailer. I pop up. Ow! I say, vision blurring from the fireworks in my head. Once it clears, I look around the trailer, which is gutted inside. Just a wood stove, a card table, some metal folding chairs, and the squeaky bed I'm in. How long have I been here? Why are you here too? The guys came by last night as I parked in my driveway. I thought Levi found out you punched me and he wanted to kick my ass for whatever I did to deserve it. The memory of my fist smashing his nose catches up with me, followed by why I did it. There's just enough light from the wood stove to see the raccoon-like bruising around Jamie's eyes, two black eyes from a broken nose. I did deserve it, Donis. Ron shouldn't have been the only one getting you up to speed on that first drive to Marquette. You had a right to know, before you agreed to pose as my girlfriend, that I was the one who had the idea of us posing as a couple. But I swear that was before I got to know you, when you were just a person in a case file, and I thought taking the initiative might help my career. It takes more effort than my groggy synapses can handle to fully process his words. Jamie takes my silence as his cue to keep talking. Levi dropped by, but he seemed happy, not mad. He invited me to Mike's party and then asked about my nose. I was thinking of an explanation when Mike tasered me. They must have stuck a needle of something in me because I woke up here this morning. He glances at his watch. It's just after 8 p.m. You've been here 6 hours. Wisps of memories come back. T, Harry, Dana. She drugged me with something. It must have been that date rape drug. The name swims through the cloudiness, Rohypnol. Did Dana say anything when she brought me here? My voice shakes as rage breaks through the roofy haze. Levi's mom is involved? Jamie is taken aback. Donis, a guy in a snowmobile helmet that covered his face carried you over his shoulder. He dumped you inside the door before tasering me. I couldn't move. That's when he shackled your leg to the bed frame. Shackled? I move each leg. There's a heavy clanking with my left one. Dana didn't bring me here? Then who else is part of this? Jamie's still talking, It takes effort to focus on his story. Removed the taser barbs and threw a log in the wood stove, 5 minutes tops. Memories form, unless I'm creating mental images to fit a story.
What did you do to her? Answer me, you...
Jamie's voice from a foggy dream. I was on the floor and you swore at someone?
Good, you remember, Jamie says. It was right before he tasered me.
Was it Grant Edwards? My eyes dart around the trailer before I scramble to look under the bed. Upside down, my head feels like someone is using it as a drum. I never saw his eyes, but he was the right size, I suppose. I flinch at Jamie's hand on my arm as I return to a sitting position.
Hey, you're okay. No one's here, Donis.
There's a seed of disquiet in his voice. Avoiding Jamie's probing gaze, I focus on the distorted memories coming back to me. I was in a truck with Dana. The fairy horn sounded overhead. She laughed when I asked for Seima to make an offering. A shiver runs through me. I meet Jamie's eyes. My mom will call my aunt. They'll look for me and contact the police. When they try reaching you, Ron will tell them you're missing too, and that he's been looking for you.
He is? You talk to him? Why isn't he here with backup?
Jamie eyeballs the door, expecting Ron to bust in. He texted this afternoon and asked if I had any contact with you since last night.
That can't be.
Jamie looks confused. Ron should be getting a tracking signal from my watch. He holds up his wrist.
Really?
I say, impressed that his watch is a James Bond gadget.
Yeah. Through satellites. My location coordinates are relayed to the FBI.
Satellites. I hold up my hand to silence him. Assess the problem. We're trapped inside a trailer on Sugar Island. The rusty bed frame creaks when I rise. A wave of nausea and more centrifuge pile onto my headache. Jamie is at my side in an instant with steady arms. He held me like this on the dance floor, leading while protecting my shoulder. It was just last night. How is that possible? A lifetime of bad things have happened since then.
Thanks.
I break away. The heavy chain is a tether. I get as far as the card table in front of the window.
Are you...
Shh. I interrupt. I'm listening. We stand absolutely still, listening for any sounds beyond the window. Gentle waves lap a nearby shore.
What do you hear, Jamie?
Uncle David taught me to avoid leading questions. Otherwise, you steer the responses to what you hope to hear.
Waves, he confirms. I've heard them since I woke up.
What can you tell me about the wave pattern? It feels good to think like a scientist.
They're just small waves, Donis.
If we're on the west shore, any freighters passing by will generate a... My mind goes blank on what it's called when those ripples hit the shore. I hate this brain fog.
A Kelvin wake? Jamie offers. Like Friday night at the breakwall?
Yes, like that, I say. The bigger the ship, the bigger the wake. Did you hear any change in the waves? Depending on freighter traffic, it could take hours for a ship to go past.
Why does it matter which side?
His voice trails off. I witness the awful moment when the answer gut punches Jamie.
Cliffs and caves.
His voice is a sinking anchor in the deepest part of Lake Superior.
You said the east side of Sugar Island is all cliffs and caves. You can't get any cell phone signals except near the ferry or the north end.
Satellites can't pick up GPS signals through stone, cement, or water. The despondent look in his eyes leaves me completely rattled. He's a grown adult, 22 years old, a cop. Yet somehow, I am the less terrified person in this trailer, the one who will say out loud what we both need to hear. The FBI doesn't know where we are, Jamie. They think you're dead in the water, like Heather. Ron's not coming. Chapter 46. In the disheartened silence that follows,
We hear voices approaching the trailer. Bet you $100 someone budges this week. I recognize Mike's voice.
Players or owners? Levi asks.
They're talking about the NHL lockout. Goddamn hockey. Quickly removing his watch, Jamie squats in front of me and grabs my untethered leg.
It wasn't turned on when they tasered me, but it's been on since I woke up, he whispers, taking off my running shoe and sliding the stretch watch band up my ankle. There should be enough of a charge still.
My laces are loose enough for him to slip my shoe back on my foot.
If there's a chance for you to leave with them, you take it.
He rises and locks eyes with me.
No matter what, Donis. Understood?
I'm too scared to even nod. A faint light is barely visible through the grimy window as they reach the trailer.
Doesn't matter, Mike says. Whoever makes the first offer has the weaker position.
Nuh-uh. Levi sounds like he's 10 years old. Wood clunks against wood. Someone fumbles with a lock. Levi comes in first. Never making eye contact, he sets a camp lantern on the table and retrieves a plastic bucket that serves as a piss pot. Levi heads to the door with it, stepping aside when Mike enters with one section of log.
They love birds, Mike says with a toothy smile. We interrupt anything?
I expect Stormy to waltz in, making his usual bow-chicka-wow-wow noises, but he doesn't. Must be on goon duty, standing guard outside. Figures. Mike opens the door of the stove and pushes the thick cylinder of wood atop whatever pieces are still going strong. Levi returns, setting the bucket next to an angled line of dark tape across the floor. A parallel line of tape is several feet away. Boundary lines marking the reach of the chains. One line for our feet, the other for our grasp. The bucket, table, and window are within the caution zone. Beyond it, the wood stove, the trailer door, and freedom. Mike takes off his puffer vest and hangs it on a hook by the door. He stands behind the table, leaning casually against the trailer wall with an amused expression. I stare at Levi, but my brother still won't look at me. Instead, he removes his backpack and pulls out a roll of paper towels before dumping the rest of the contents on the table. Bottled water, sports drinks, and protein bars scatter. My thirst springs to life when a rogue bottle of water rolls off the table to join us by the bed. Jamie drops the bottle when picking it up. He hands it to me after grabbing a second time. I chug half before offering him the rest. He motions for me to finish it. Cold water sloshes noisily in my empty stomach.
Your reward for being so nice to Donnie defense. Mike tosses the water to Jamie, who fumbles that bottle as well. Good thing you're not playing football.
I grit my teeth. Let's see how you guys like Donnie offense. What's going on, Levi? I demand.
We need your help, he says, finally meeting my eyes.
Jamie reaches for my hand. Now is not the time for him to get mushy with a triple squeeze. He stops at 2. His code from Shagala. 2 squeezes meant keep going. We who? I say. You and the guys? Your mom who drugged me? Who all is we? Levi shakes his head.
Forget about everyone else. I need your help.
This is how you ask for help? I shake my leg iron. Did you buy these shackles at Home Depot or Ace Hardware?
We found them in a shack. Figured those Al Capone stories were true.
So you're a wannabe gangster? I repeat my first question. What's going on, Levi?
A business opportunity.
A what? I bellow. Jamie's hand pumps mine once, like a shock. Shagala squeeze code. Stop. I serve it back with more force. No, you stop.
Just hear me out.
Levi's Adam's apple bobs with the gulp he takes before continuing.
I tried bringing it up that day at Chimukwa when I punched the asshole who insulted you.
You did? My surprise is genuine.
Yeah, I asked if you were going to stay in the Sioux because you were dating him.
He half nods at Jamie.
if me and you could go into business together someday. The day I asked Levi to look for Dad's scarf, the scarf he later lied about not having. What kind of business has you doing this bullshit? I shake my leg again for the sound effect, because I thought you meant, like, buy a house to rent to college students. The double squeeze from Jamie means I'm back on track. Here's the thing. Levi starts his team captain pep talk this way. Sometimes I'd wait in the hallway outside your uncle's classroom before hockey practice. You were out there just lurking in the hall like a creeper? Levi came by once in a while to mooch snacks for him and the guys, but I always assumed he just strolled right in. Levi shrugs and continues. He'd ask you about chemicals. What would happen if you mixed this with that? You'd think out loud till you figured out if it was poisonous or what the reaction might be. Coldness washes over me. He listened to Uncle David and me playing What Would Happen Next. I knew you were smart, Donis, Levi says. But hearing how your mind worked, I realize what a genius you really are. I'm surprised to see his expression filled with admiration. I hate that my first impulse is to bask in his proud smile. Watching you two dance around this shit is excruciating, Mike cuts in, moving closer. Jamie's firm grip pulls me a half step backward. His adrenaline flows through our joined hands to flood my system too. Here's the thing, Mike mimics Levi's earlier lead-in. 2 years ago, I'm helping Levi and Stormy write a business plan for Coach Bobby's class. We're tossing around bullshit ideas, like franchising the Naughty Nickel. And Levi goes, why should big city drug dealers end up with more per cap dollars than any tribal member? He was right. If people are going to buy the stuff anyway, why not buy local? He turns to Levi. You and Stormy turned in a different plan, to put a Tim Hortons in Chimakwa, right? Something's off, but I can't pinpoint it. The stuff Dana put in my tea. It's as if I'm 2 seconds behind every play on the ice. How about you tell the next part about Travis? Mike says, grabbing a folding chair to sit just inside the caution zone. He doesn't offer the other one to my brother. As Levi opens his mouth to speak, my own thoughts whisper from some other place. This is it. How it happened. How we all ended up in this trailer. Travis's ma dated some guy from Las Vegas who got hired in the VIP room at the casino. He made serious bank and tips and spent a lot of it on Angie, even got her a new ride. I try to identify what's different about Levi. He seems younger somehow. Turns out, high-stakes poker wasn't the only thing Vegas dude was dealing, Levi says. He got her to switch from vodka to meth. Angie could party all night with no hangover. Lost weight, too. She gave free samples of go-go juice to her res friends. It's his breezy use of meth lingo that pisses me off. How can... I start to lay into him, but Jamie's hand pulses for me to stop. His thoughts are inside my head as well. Don't get riled. Just let them talk. Levi continues. Travis wasn't playing in a league anymore, so he'd hang out at the old city rink looking for a pickup game. He never said whether the Vegas dude gave him a free sample or he helped himself to it. Travis told us meth wasn't a big deal. Just made him skate faster, gave him stamina to play for hours. My brother leaves out his own role and why Travis wasn't on any league team. Mike jumps in. Tag team storytelling like the guys always do. Vegas dude starts knocking Angie around for not meeting her sales quotas. As long as he did it on the res, tribal police couldn't touch his non-native ass. But they could harass him, and the casino could fire him. My dad says the tribe gets rid of troublemakers during the 1 year new employee probation period. They don't have to give a reason, and the fired person can't appeal it. Mike gleefully adds, someone gave Vegas dude a free sample of advice to get the hell out of town. Travis could help Angie with the business, Levi says. He wanted to, Donis. No one twisted his arm.
He was smart and figured out how to make meth even better than Vegas, dude. Their only problem was in scaling up production. All we did was invest in a growing business. That's all they say they did, but Levi doesn't know that I know he did way more than invest. And he wasn't a mule forced to do it. Levi was a distributor, risking his hockey career. What would you do if you could get away with anything? If you grew up getting special treatment? If you had a friend like Travis to take the fall for a big mistake? Mike tag teams back into the story. Travis became his own best customer. He started adding psychedelic mushrooms to batches of meth. And last Christmas, when he was crying over Lily, he experimented with all kinds of wild stuff in the product. My breath catches at hearing her name. Levi tried experimenting with the meth, but it's the one thing your brother actually sucks at. Mike shoots him a look of annoyance. The hair prickles at the back of my neck. Well, two things, he continues. Levi couldn't pitch a simple business plan to his sister last winter when it would have prevented all the fuck-ups that happened since then. My brother doesn't tell Mike to fuck off. He just stands there and takes it. There's a lilt to Mike's voice now. If you would have been part of our team, Donnie, we could have gotten help for Travis. Lily would still be alive. Don't talk about her, I snap, but my heart is in my throat. It's true. I could have saved her. If only, don't fall for it, Donis. Jamie is inside my head again. The scientist part of my brain steps in. I think back to all the times Levi had an idea and Mike provided a key suggestion and a sequenced plan. Sometimes a chemical is harmless in one form, but becomes toxic under specific conditions. Mike is a catalyst. When Mike kissed me, one of the excuses I gave was that my brother wouldn't like it. Believe me when I tell you, I'm not afraid of Levi. Levi may be team captain on the ice, but in this trailer, Mike Edwards is in charge. You're the brains, I hiss at Mike, the goalie who can always anticipate where the puck is headed. Jamie squeezes my hand. Stop. Oh, Donnie, it's hard being the smartest person in the room. Mike rises. I thought you and I had that in common. Turns out, my dad was right. He imitates Grant. Winners outthink the losers. Winners see opportunities the losers notice in the rearview mirror. I used to think my dad was full of shit, but Tenacious G outthinks everyone. He always plays the long game. A look passes between Mike and Levi. My brother exits, casting a worried look behind his shoulder, and I brace myself for the finale he didn't want to witness. Now I've got a story for you, Firekeeper's daughter, Mike says. Once upon a time, there was a smart princess who fell in love with the new guy in town. The prince that her brother encouraged to date his sister. She was presented with an opportunity to help her brother. A choice to make. To help or not to help. To save the prince or be responsible for a tragic ending. Mike yawns while casually stretching his arms above his head. We'll be back tomorrow for your answer. For Jamie's sake, I hope you go with happily ever after. Mike walks to the door and reaches for the doorknob. He turns to tell us one last thing. A shudder runs through me. My sweaty hand is still intertwined with Jamie's. I never thought I'd want to be like my old man. Turns out, all of his lectures and lessons taught me how important it is to set a goal and do whatever it takes to see it through. Mike turns the doorknob. My dad can be extremely persistent when he wants something. He smiles. But you know all about that, don't you, Donnie Defense? My chest tightens. Mike knows what his dad did to me. Chapter 47. I can't breathe. The trailer is too hot. I blink to find myself sitting on the bed.
Jamie presses something damp and cool against my forehead. I need to know what it is, as if this one fact will provide comfort. The handkerchief from his suit jacket pocket.
You're okay, Donis. They're gone. I'm here with you. You're safe.
His voice is soothing, but I get stuck on his last word. Safe.
My dad can be extremely persistent when he wants something. But you know all about that, don't you?
Jamie saw my frantic kicks and air punches last night. He tried alerting Ron that something was wrong. I wait for him to repeat his question from the Overlook.
What happened to you?
He doesn't. I think Jamie is starting to figure it out. I watch for a recriminating glance, a tisk-tisk, a lecture. It doesn't come. A trickle of sweat runs the length of my back. It's a sauna inside the trailer. Jamie gives me a sports drink and pats my forehead again. I take a few sips before offering it to him. He peels the wrapper of a protein bar like a banana before handing it to me. My stomach growls as I devour it. Chain smoker style, he unpeels another bar while I chew my last bite of the first one.
Let's have you turn off the tracker on the watch to save the battery, okay? He motions toward my ankle. It's the knob on the side. You push it in to power down the tracker, so it's just an ordinary watch.
I reach down and push the knob in.
We know the guys will return for you. They need you wherever their lab is set up. We have to hope that it's off the island or at least somewhere a signal could be detected.
As soon as you're away from these rocks, pull the knob out and turn the tracker back on, okay? I look at this person, backlit by a lantern and dancing orange lights, kneeling in front of me. What do I actually know about him? He is 22. He has strands of copper hidden in his curly brown hair. His deepest laughter tugs at the bottom of his scar. He was a pairs figure skater before he switched to hockey. He pinches the bridge of his nose when frustrated. He doesn't know his tribe or clan. His fingertips are as soft as a whisper against my skin. He takes the black olives off his pizza. He kisses with confidence, no holding back. His eyes look ordinary from a distance, but up close, they are glorious. He was abandoned before. He always drives the speed limit. He speaks French and Spanish. He thought he was going to die when they cut his face. He prayed to Creator when he felt for Lily's pulse at her carotid artery, prayed to find it. He wants to belong to something bigger than himself. He is stronger than he appears. He loves me. And finally, when he agreed to this undercover assignment, he never envisioned any of this happening. Unable to keep my eyelids open, I lie down on the mattress with my back pressed against the wall. The cool metal against my shirt keeps me from dripping with sweat like Jamie. My hands shake with the tiniest of tremors, a side effect of the Rohypnol, their plan, or both. I drift off to the sound of gentle waves stroking the shore somewhere on Sugar Island. Orange lights move against the walls. Only it's not a trailer anymore. It's a rib cage illuminated with orange stripes. I'm not just inside the tiger. I am the tiger. I crouch low, unseen, watching three boys. My eyes never leave them until a beautiful black jaguar, Panthera onca, glides past. He's not supposed to be this far north. It's not his territory. He doesn't see the threat until they circle him. An owl hoots in the distance. Something slithers nearby. I remain hidden. No one ever needs to know I am here. They transform. Three boys become a creature with Levi's face, spiky blonde hair, a concave chest, and six muscular arms, which extend like rubber. Jamie, in a black suit, stands where the panther was. The creature's punches are like machine gun fire. Jamie's white shirt rips to reveal abdominal muscles already forming purple bruises. The only sounds are the cracking of his ribs as he tries to catch his breath. Ron shouts from a distance, "I can't find him, Donis." I leap from my safe spot,
already tasting the creature's warm blood in my throat. But I'm jerked back and hit the ground with an oof. My ankle is tethered to an old bed. The creature transforms into three guys I no longer recognize. I roar at each one. The first won't meet my eyes. The second fades as if he was never there. The third smiles, revealing teeth that are much sharper than mine. Jamie falls to the ground face first, rolling over to frantically swing and kick at the air. I listen for breath sounds, but there aren't any. His movements slow until his arms and legs go still. I cannot reach him. Jamie will die believing I abandoned him. Hot breath on my neck turns me into a frozen statue of a tiger, petrified as a snake slithers up my leg. I wake up, heart racing, with my forehead and palms pressed against the cool wall. I'm scared. I want my mom. I gotta get out of here. I turned over in the night, but Jamie didn't. His arm found my waist, and his face is buried in my hair. Each time he exhales, his breath seeps through the tangled mess to tickle my neck. I know Jamie's breath is not Grant's, but rational fears are still terrifying. As I climb over Jamie, my full bladder shifts uncomfortably. It's not my first time using a piss pot. Super rustic cabins and hunting camps in the UP don't have running water. A bucket outside the front door means no trip to a spider-filled outhouse in the middle of the night. After finishing, I sit on the floor at the center of the closest masking tape line, staring at the wood stove. I wrap my arms around my knees, pulled up to my chest. The only sounds are the gentle waves beyond the trailer and the sizzling pop of one sizable log in the stove. Wood isn't solid. It's made of cellulose, which transforms during combustion into a gas. The gas builds up until it breaks through the cell wall at its most vulnerable spot. That's all the popping is, pressure finding a weakness. I try to shake off the bad dream by organizing my thoughts. What I know. 1. The guys, Grant and Angie Flint, are responsible for the meth. 2. Dana drugged me and had me brought here. 3. They're using Jamie as incentive for me to cook meth for them. 4. There is no way they will let Jamie go. 5. Levi is the weakest link. What I don't know. 1. What is Mom doing right now? 2. Did Levi have anything to do with Uncle David's death? 3. What is the extent of Dana's involvement? 4. How were Heather and Robin mixed up in this? Were their deaths accidental or intentional? 5. What does Mike have planned for Jamie? 6. How far would Stormy's inner goon go without any limits? 7. How do I stop loving the brother I don't recognize anymore? I sit until the trailer lightens with Zagasekwe's song, Beginning a New Day. Rising, I stretch my stiff limbs. My tailbone is sore. The tiredness behind my eyes feels permanent. At the window, I use my sleeve to rub away soot to stare at a wall of darkness just beyond. Metamorphosed igneous peridotite. We are in a trailer hidden in black rock. East side, Jamie says from the bed. Not a question at all. He gets up to pee in the bucket before returning to bed. Bone weary already, and the day is only minutes old. I heard waves and pops in my trance bubble, but no snoring. Jamie was awake the entire time as well. Jamie's in the spot I had last night, his back against the wall. He pats the bed in front of him for me to join him. Let's sleep for a bit. They won't be back for a while, and we're too exhausted to think straight. We can come up with a strategy when we're less fuzzy, he says. I lie on my back next to Jamie and stare at the curved aluminum ceiling. It's comfortable in the trailer, not too hot or too cold. It will cool off steadily, though, as the fire dies down through the day. At some point, Jamie will try to cuddle for warmth. You need to face the wall, I say.
His eyebrow rises, but he rolls over. The trailer lightens with the only sun that's likely to reach us. I say a silent prayer to Creator for Zunga Dewin. Today is a day for courage.
Would it be okay for me to put my arm around you? I ask.
Of course, he says. I turn toward Jamie and drape my arm over him. I like the feel of his body next to me this way. It calms me to know I'm not alone. I take a deep breath.
You can't put your arm around me like this because...
Jamie tenses. I pause, then continue slowly.
Because Grant Edwards held me down from behind when he attacked me last night in his hotel room. I went with him because he said he had a security video of me snooping around his home office from that Sunday night we were at their house. Jamie doesn't say anything for what feels like an hour.
You're gonna leave here today, he says finally. The tracker will lead Ron to you. Tell him everything. He's a good agent. The FBI will take it from there. They'll get Grant Edwards, and you can put this behind you, Donis. You're gonna be okay.
I don't know whether I believe him or just want to so badly, but I finally relax. He rests his hand on top of mine in front of him. His thumb strokes the soft pad between my thumb and index finger with the same rhythm as the waves from Lake George. We wake up at the same time, as the voices approach the trailer. Both of us scramble to stand next to the bed. We each reach for the other's hand at the same time. I'm lightheaded from standing too rapidly and my heartbeat racing in fear.
I'll agree to whatever they say, I whisper. I'll tell Ron everything as soon as he finds me. We will come back for you.
Jamie gulps the air as if he's about to dive into the deepest pool.
I love you, he says quickly. No matter what happens, Donis, I love you. If everything goes bad, save yourself and get away from here.
My lips are at his ear now.
Trust me, Levi is the weakest link. Someone fumbles with the lock. I don't know why the truth matters now, only that it does.
I love you, Oji Shingwe.
Chapter 48. They repeat their entrance from last night. Levi enters first and goes straight for the bucket. Mike goes to the wood stove. He's brought only one small log. My stomach drops at the implication that Jamie might not be alive long enough to warrant a larger one.
Well, princess, what's it gonna be?
Mike says when they finish their tasks. Letting go of Jamie's hand, I step forward. What assurance do I have that Jamie will be safe if I agree to help you? I ask Mike, because I don't trust Levi. Mike blinks his surprise.
What?
Levi says with high-pitched shock. Did I stutter? My voice is ice. You're a liar and a snake. I look to Mike and repeat my question. What assurance do I have that Jamie will be safe if I agree to help you? Mike assesses me with a tilt of his head, furrowed brow, and lips pursed as if he's a Nish giving directions.
What are you talking about, Donis? Levi asks.
You lied about Dad's scarf, I seethe. You knew how much it meant to me, and you said you couldn't find it, but you knew exactly where it was. I take another step forward as far as the chain will allow. I found it in your closet yesterday. If you'd lie about Dad, anything out of your mouth is sketchy. I give one last disgusted look at my brother before turning to Mike. At least with Mike, we understand each other, don't we? Mike does the smirk that reminds me of his father. I swallow the bile rising in my throat. My mask is one of cool detachment with Mike and unbridled fury toward Levi.
What are you doing, Donis? Jamie says, clearly alarmed.
You were the one who broke into my room?
Levi is bewildered, outraged, and embarrassed. A mixture of emotions swirled together yet still discernible.
Yep. I'm impressed, princess, Mike says as he steps into the caution zone. Put your leg on the table.
My leg?
I fight to keep my voice calm. How could he know about the watch around my right ankle?
You want to lose that leg iron, don't you?
But you, Prince Charming? He nods toward Jamie. Lie down on the bed facing the wall so you don't try anything funny. Unless you prefer to get tasered. We follow Mike's commands at the same time. Behind me, the rusty bed frame squeaks with Jamie's movements while I pull the card table closer so my left leg can rest on it. Mike leans over the table to insert a key in the padlock at my ankle. My newly unshackled leg feels as if it might float away. It's my right leg now that has the weight of the world around it.
Thank you, I say.
Mike smiles benevolently.
You can get back up, Prince Charming, he says.
Princess Donnie, he will be safe because I will tell Levi to keep him safe. So you're taking me to your meth setup? I ask Mike, adding a glimpse of relief for him to see.
That's the plan, he replies. Although, I must say, you're awfully concerned about the safety of a guy you cheated on.
What? Levi and Jamie say in unison.
Donnie banged my dad at Shagala.
At last, Mike's smile reaches his ice-blue eyes. I recoil. Mike thinks it was a consensual hookup? I want to combust in a ball of fury. I can't take back my clearly visible reaction, so I transform it into anger at being tattled on. To further sell it, I add uncomfortable fidgeting and a guilty look at Jamie. Jamie picks up the cue immediately. I know he is just playing his part, but his look of hurt and confusion cuts at me.
You're a cheater?
Levi stares as if I'm a stranger. He doesn't give me time to answer, instead turning to Mike.
You knew?
I always know when my dad chases tail. Mike shrugs. He's so predictable. He won't let me have a girlfriend during hockey season. Meanwhile, he screws everything and my mom pretends not to notice.
Mike struts right up to me. He gave Robin the heave-ho and started scoping you out.
Out with the old, in with the new.
As I glare at Mike, a disturbing thought comes to me. He took Robin to Shagala 3 years ago and kissed me a few weeks ago. Maybe Mike's attentions had nothing to do with me, and we're about proving something to his dad instead. I can't get distracted. I need to stick to the plan I made while staring at the wood stove this morning. My plan, to get the weakest link.
Well, now that you've told Levi what a snake he is, Mike begins, and he knows the truth about his cheating puck slut sister, I think he should be the one to take you to your new work site. I'll stay here with Prince Jamie while you two siblings go on.
Mike is pleased with himself. He set up this hat trick, a hockey trifecta where a player scores 3 goals in 1 game, revealing a secret to turn Levi against me, ruining my relationship with my boyfriend, showing me that he's in charge and capable of outsmarting me.
Anything you want to say before you go? Mike asks me.
I pivot toward Jamie and say in the most pathetic voice I can, I am so sorry. It was a stupid mistake and didn't mean anything. I'll do anything to make it up to you. My back is to Mike and Levi, who cannot see my wink. Trust me, Levi is the weakest link. The plan was to find a way to separate Levi from Mike somehow. My only chance to talk sense into my brother is to get him alone. I was hoping that if they were going to take me away from the trailer, that it would be just one of them and not both. I had to make sure it was Levi, and the best way to do that was to make Mike believe I didn't want anything to do with my brother. Mike showed me last night that he enjoys opportunities to shake me up. It's part of his need to prove he's the alpha in this operation. I keep my mask on, playing the part of a girl who just got shown who the boss is.
Oh, and Donnie, if anything keeps Levi from getting back here within 2 hours, it will not be a happy ending for Prince Charming.
Mike motions for me to go to the door with Levi. I shoot one last angry look at Mike while, inside, I try to keep from breaking into a gleeful triple-speed smoke dance. My plan is going exactly as I'd hoped.